Hey everyone, Adam here from the Pine Barrens Institute, and this is episode 5 of Cryptids and Conversations. This time around, we're going to be doing something different. We are not going to be talking about cryptozoology. Instead, we are going to be talking about my second favorite passion, and that is Wisconsin folklore. Because of this, I am going to share a few tales that originate from the state, as well as one of our most famous ghost stories. We're going to give this a shot, see how we like it. If people enjoy it, we can make it a recurring thing. The state has so much history to offer and so many tales that have been passed down from generation to generation that this is something that we could, you know, feature for a long time. So sit back, relax, listen to these tales, and when everything's said and done, let me know what you think. Before we begin, just some quick background information. The majority of these tales come from one of my favorite people, Charles E. Brown. Charles was the curator of the Museum of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin and was the secretary of the Wisconsin Archaeological Society. Between 1921 and 1945, Charles took it upon himself to preserve the stories, folklore, legends, and anything else that he felt needed to be saved for future generations. And he compiled them all into 47 individual pamphlets. These pamphlets totaled 444 pages. Some of the topics of these pamphlets were folklore from the Wisconsin Native Americans, lumberjack folklore, steamboating folklore, local history. He wrote an entire pamphlet on sea serpents, which I have gotten a ton of information for in my articles. And he also put out a few ghost tales. And that's where we're primarily going to be pulling these stories from. Along with them, we're also going to be taking a few from Wisconsin Lore, a 1962 book written by Robert E. Gard and L.G. Sordin. This book was about 400 pages and pretty much did the same thing. It covered a variety of topics, all ranging from Wisconsin, some, you know, just a few sentences, some multiple pages. The cool thing about both of these pamphlets, as well as these authors, is they took them direct from the source, right from the people. As the people said them, that's how they recorded them, that's how they saved them. So most of the time, the sources were not listed. But because of the reputation of these authors, it's pretty much taken at face value that these did come from actual people. None of these were made up. People still tell some of these stories today. I've been to a few events where these stories have been told around campfires, on Halloween, stuff like that. Most people outside of the state have never heard them, which is why we feel like sharing them. So here we go. Let's get into story number one. The Skeleton. From the pamphlet Ghost Tales, Short Stories for Use at the Fireside and Campfire. Old Time Wisconsin and Other Tales of Ghosts, Spooks, Phantoms, Spirits, Skulls, Skeletons, Ghouls, Hexes, Undertakers, and Burying Grounds. Published in Madison, Wisconsin in 1931. The Skeleton. Two young men who were pursuing medical studies at Rush Medical College roomed on the top floor of a tenement building in a rather squalid quarter of the town. They were hard driven to make ends meet, as such students formerly were. The rather cheap living in this poor district suited their slender purses. Occupying the rooms on the floor just below them was a Hungarian family. This family was rather queer, but was mostly good folk. On at least one night of every week, they had a habit of inviting in some of their old country relatives and friends for a party. This generally happened on a night when the young medics were endeavoring to study. One of the guests had a zither and another brought along an accordion. These two provided the music for endless hard-stepping round dances, accompanied by loud-voiced singing of old country songs. These hilarious doings began at about 8 o'clock and continued with almost no intermission until midnight. The medics endured these weekly celebrations as long as they could. They pounded on the floor, they complained to the agent of the building, and they even complained to the family themselves, but to no avail. The celebrations continued, so they resolved to take matters into their own hands. One Saturday night, when the riotous merrymaking had gone on for about an hour, they hit on a good plan for quieting the family. One of the boys tied a large nail to a piece of black thread and lowered it carefully to the window of the family below. After banging on this tic-tac several times against the window pane, he again drew it upward. Now the dancing ceased and the boys heard the curtain raised as someone peered out into the darkness to learn the cause of the unexpected noise. When the curtain was again lowered, the tic-tac on the window pane was repeated. On each occasion of the use of the tic-tac, there was silence in the room below. Then the music and the dance were resumed. Now, the medics determined on extreme measures. They were the owners of a particular hideous jointed human skeleton. Attaching a rope to this bundle of bones, they lowered it down to opposite the window, and then banged one of its arms against the pane. Almost immediately, the curtain was raised and all who could do so peered out of the window. The frequent tic-tacking already reduced the family to a very nervous state of mind. Now there was the greatest commotion as chairs and other furniture was overturned by the frightened family on the way to the door. One could hear them shrieking and falling over one another down the long dark staircase and landing with a thud at the bottom. That was the end of the celebrations held there and of the family themselves. Believing that this place was haunted by an evil spirit or devil, the family soon removed themselves to another abode. Peace reigned thereafter. Story number 2, Trailed by a Catamount, from Ghost Tales. In pioneer days, a young man living in a country settlement in southern Wisconsin had a sweetheart residing in a town about 7 miles distant. As he had no horse, he was obliged to make his courting visits on foot. The country through which he passed on these occasions was largely wild and uncultivated land, only 2 or 3 farm homes being scattered along the road. There were wolves, bears, and wild cats in this region. One dark night, as he was returning from one of his weekly visits, he thought that he heard something in the road behind him, so he halted and looked behind. The moon had just emerged from beneath a cloud, lighting the dirt road with its beams, but he saw nothing. The brush-lined road seemed to be clear. He resumed to his walking. After a while, he again thought he heard a slight noise, so he turned again, but with the same result as before. Now he quickened his pace, for he felt that he was being followed. Could it be a spook? He had heard of their following people. Feeling very uneasy, he turned again and again to view the road in his rear. On one of these occasions, he thought that he could see indistinctly the form of some large animal. Recently, he had heard stories of large catamount or panther, which had killed settler stock over a quite wide territory. Now he decided that he was being trailed by one of these large and powerful wildcats. In turning again, he thought that he could see it quite plainly in the road about 100 feet behind him. It moved into the brush at the roadside. Now he was in a state approaching terror, and he broke into a run. He thought that he could hear it running behind. A few minutes later, he neared a farmhouse. This farmer he knew to have several large and ugly dogs. He expected to hear these watchful animals bark as he approached the house, but they uttered not a single sound. Evidently, they smelled one of their ancient enemies and chose to remain quiet. The young man now reached the farmhouse and by his loud knocking aroused the farmer. Here he told his story and was asked to remain for the night. The footprints of the catamount from which he had so fortunately escaped were plainly to be seen in the dusty surface of the road on the following morning. Story number 3, The Night Owl, from Ghost Tales. Of all the fierce creatures of childhood and other days, the night owl was the very worst. A consort of witches and wizards and of other weird and unearthly beings, the night owl was the terror, especially of disobedient children. We suspect that he was of German origin because he was most frequently mentioned by children of Teutonic parentage. During the daylight hours, his abode was supposed to be in caves, in tombs, and in other dark and mysterious places. After dark, he was abroad, generally sitting on a limb of some convenient tree or some treetop, from which station he could watch the windows of homes in which there were young children. Naughty boys and girls were taken to the window to see him. Peering out into the darkness through the window pane, the children could see his piercing black eyes, yellow-ringed and bright and shining. He was always watching. One good look at this awful night bird was enough. Children who had been noisy and naughty quickly quieted down and became tractable after seeing the watchful night owl. It was not known whether he ever carried away any naughty children. He might have done so, for he was believed to be the sentinel of and servant of the witches. To them he reported all of the misdeeds of children. We have not seen the Night Owl for some years, but no doubt he was still on duty somewhere. Story number 4, The Potter's Field, from Ghost Tales. The Potter's Field in a certain Wisconsin county was a rather dreary and desolate plot of ground. The land was boggy and barren, and unsuitable for pasturage or agriculture. Here a neighboring city buried its unclaimed and homeless dead. Among those here interred were suicides whose bodies had been recovered from rivers and a lake, or of who have ended their melancholy lives in other ways and places. Victims of murders and disease, lunatics, drunkards, tramps and strays, and other unfortunates of humankind were found here, a last resting place. They were placed in cheap pine boxes, carted to the burying ground, and stowed away without ceremony in rather hastily dug graves. Few persons, if any, mourned their loss. Because of its nature, this city of the dead had a rather unsavory reputation. Almost no one ever came to visit it, or to there mourn for the departed. No one cared to linger there. It was reputed to be a haunt of ghouls who came on dark nights to exhume bodies for the use of medical men, or to dig for articles of value thought to have been buried with the dead. It was also a resort of spooks and other gruesome creatures. Lights were seen to flicker there after dark. Their nature none cared to investigate. Wooden crosses or painted boards stood at the head of the mounded up or sunken graves. These bore a number, or were unnumbered completely. This lonely burial place adjoined one of the pasture lot fields of our grandmother's farm on the Blue Mound Road. A path ran diagonally across the potter's field from this pasture and across another field to a road beyond. This was a shortcut to the village, nearly a mile away. In going to the village on errands, it was the wont of our girl and boy cousins to take this path. These journeys were sometimes taken in the early summer evenings. There being a small company of children, they would start away bravely enough, the older ones leading and the younger ones in the rear. As they walked down the path among the graves in a single file, the springy nature of the ground caused the nearby crosses and boards to move to and fro or up and down. Then someone would become frightened, and the entire little party would begin to hurry and to run. Now, as they ran faster and faster, all of the grave markers would appear to be moving. It was as if their dead were trying to arise from their graves and pursue the intruders. Of course, the children never halted until in their mad flight they had scaled the fence on the other side of the cemetery. In the field beyond, they stopped out of breath and tired. On their way back from the village, they always came by the country road, making a wide detour to avoid the potter's field. Nevertheless, the old burying ground was such an attraction to these children that only a few evenings later they were again ready to adventure across the field of the dead. The old potter's field disappeared many years ago. Whatever may have been its ghostly secrets, they are now entirely lost. Story number 5, Old Country Tombstones, from the pamphlet Ghost Tales. As children, we found our occasional visits to the country cemetery always very interesting. There, one must be on one's best behavior. In wandering about among the graves, one must be very careful not to tread on any of them. Dire things had been known to happen to persons who did this. To pick any of the flowers which grew on graves or in flower beds was a grave misdemeanor also. The dead resented the plucking of any of their posies. Their spirits were known to wreak vengeance on those who did this. Our interest was particularly attracted by the monuments, of which there were many different forms. Slabs, cubes, rectangles, spheres, broken columns, obelisks, cubes surmounted by urns, and others. Most interesting of these were the quite numerous old white marble tombstones of the pioneers and other old settlers of the country. Most of these had carved near their tops such old Yankee devices as reclining lambs, weeping willows, rose sprays, gates ajar, cross and crown, square and compass, three links, and many others. Some gravestones were badly weathered, others had broken off at their bases and fallen into the grass. The epitaphs carved on these stones were read and reread. Not a few were of a particularly melancholy nature. One that we always visited carried the cheerful verse, "Remember, friend, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you shall be. Prepare for death and follow me." That tombstone and epitaph was always searched for. After we had read it again, we often scattered in several directions, but there were others just as interesting. It was a custom of some people to place on the graves of young children a box with a glass front through which there could be glimpsed a wreath of wax, wool, cloth, or other flowers, a stuffed pigeon, and the child's favorite toys. These graves we always visited. The water of the cemetery pump always had a peculiar taste. We fancied that this was due to its contact with dead men's bones, yet we always tasted it. The old sexton we feared because of his somber vocation. The old stone receiving vault was a place of greatest mystery. We wished that we might someday find it open and look into its depths. Families living at a distance often brought a picnic lunch and spent the entire day in the cemetery. One never visits the old village without a longing to wander out to the old cemetery and to see all of its varied memorials once more. Story number 6, The Devil Got Uncle Joe, from Ghost Tales. The Undertaker's establishment was situated in a rather poor quarter of the town. Two medical colleges nearby were offering good fees for corpses, but there had been no deaths in the area. Business for this undertaker was depressingly poor. When an old man living across the alley from the undertaking parlor died, business showed signs of picking up. The undertaker lost no time in securing the corpse for embalming. Uncle Joe had died of a rather unusual ailment, and for a medical school, they were eager to pay the undertaker the handsome sum of $65 for his remains. On the day of the funeral, Uncle Joe's body was exposed to the view of a host of his friends in the old man's humble home. After the funeral service, the coffin was removed across the alley to the undertaker's rooms under the pretense of giving some final treatment to the body. Here, unobserved, the crafty undertaker and his assistant quickly removed the corpse. Then, they filled the empty casket with chunks of coal and slabs of wood and sealed it. It was placed in the waiting hearse, and the mournful procession proceeded to the cemetery beyond the town limits. At the grave the choir had sung, the reverend had just offered the final prayer, and the undertaker and his helper were just about to lower the coffin into the yawning grave when a loud shout was heard. Everyone in the audience turned. Hobbling toward the grave as fast as his rheumatic limbs would permit came old Uncle Rastus. He had been unable to be present at the ceremonies at the cabin home. He wanted to have a last look at his old friend. Of course, the impatient undertaker loudly demurred. The coffin had been sealed and otherwise fastened. The last words had been spoken. He warned the mourners of the probable terrible consequences of again disturbing the remains of the dead. In his expostulations, he was supported by the reverend. But such was the clamor raised by old Uncle Rastus, seconded now by the other mourners, that the undertaker at last consented to remove the seal and pry open the coffin lid. The shadows of night were already beginning to fall when this was accomplished. When the superstitious crowd who gathered about the casket saw that the devil had already taken possession of the body of poor old Uncle Joe and changed his corpse to coal and kindling wood, they stampeded in every direction, and there were not enough tall trees in the cemetery to hold all of them. Uncle Rastus, also, had dropped his cane and was seen bounding away in the distance and hurdling fences and other obstructions in his path with all the speed and grace of a runaway colt. Story number 7, More and More Tombstones, from Ghost Tales. When Uncle Bill was a young man, he received an appointment as a station agent on the line of the old W and St. P. Railroad. The station was a small one at the western terminal of the line, away out in the prairie country. There was a tiny settlement there. All about it, for many miles, were large farms devoted to grain growing. At this small station, he was the sole employee. His duties were numerous. He was the station agent, telegrapher, train dispatcher, baggie agent, freight agent, and deputy mail clerk. For these combined services, he received the princely salary of $40 a month. The numerous duties he was required to perform were not, as a general thing, too heavy. He opened the depot door at 6 a.m. and generally closed his office at about 10 o'clock at night. He ate his dinner and his supper when he found the time to do so. There were but two regular trains a day, one into and the same one out of the station. Now and then, when he was busiest, a traveling salesman would appear from somewhere with four or five big sample trucks to be weighed, checked, and loaded on the train. After several bad seasons, this had been a year with a heavy grain harvest. The farmers had plenty of money, and they were buying machinery and supplies for their farms and homes. So there were always freight cars to be unloaded. One day in the early autumn, a large and heavy boxcar was left by the trainmen on the station siding. On examining it, Uncle Will found it to be filled with crates containing marble tombstones. An enterprising agent had encouraged the farmers to purchase monuments for the graves of their dead. Our agent believed that he should have some help in moving these heavy stones, so he sent a telegram to the superintendent requesting assistance. The reply came. It read, "Unload car immediately." A second telegram sent was ignored entirely. It was evident that there was no intention of sending any help. With the assistance of the farmers, after the very hardest kind of backbreaking work, poor Uncle Bill managed at last to get the car unloaded. About a week later, a freight engine arrived and deposited two large boxcars on the siding. The agent was very much depressed when he learned that these cars were also filled with a precious freight of marble tombstones. Again, he sent a telegram asking permission to hire two men to help unload the slabs. To this message, he received no answer. So he sent a second telegram asking for one man. Then came a reply. Unload cars without delay. No excuses accepted. So he was again obliged to use his own efforts. It was a killing job. The stones were hard to handle. He cut his hands and tore his clothes. With the help of a few farmers who came with their wagons, he was finally able to dispose of the second shipment of tombstones. He was a physical wreck. His only thanks were several telegrams from the August superintendent charging him with sleeping on the job. Of course, he was mad. Only a few days later, before he had the time to become rested from his previous labors, two more cars arrived. When he unlocked the doors, he was stunned to discover that these also contained memorials for the Granger dead. Now he was mad clear through. The farmers for many miles round had evidently entered a monument buying orgy. There was no knowing when the tombstone shipments might end. He sent another pleading message to the superintendent's office. The ungracious response read, "Unload cars. Send no further telegrams. Cars badly needed elsewhere. Rush." He was paralyzed. Then he sent the final message to his superior, "Am going out to join the tombstone business. Please accept my resignation." So there we have six folk tales recorded by Charles E. Brown. While the tales aren't necessarily of anything of major importance, they might not be considered scary, they might not be considered, you know, all that interesting, it is fun to read and listen to tales that people spoke to one another years and years and years ago from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. It's fun to get that little look into our history as a state. But the one I'm going to read next is considered one of the most famous Wisconsin ghost stories. It stems from when lead mining was big in the southwest part of the state, and when a large influx of immigrants from England, Wales, Ireland, from areas up in Canada were starting to flock into the state. So a lot of them were bringing their superstitions and ghost stories with them. This particular story took place in Ridgeway, which is about 25 miles from Madison. When it's told, it captures this idea of a prankster ghost, very mischievous. It was one of the most famous at the time. It was told often in saloons, bars, hotels, everything around the area. But the original story of the Ridgeway ghost is actually quite scary to hear. I know that it's hard to find the actual story because there's so many different retellings of it, but through research I have the actual story here in front of me. So this will be the last one that I'm reading, but I think it's the best one, and that's why I wanted to save it for last. So without further ado, here is the legend of the Ridgeway ghost. Thank you. The year was 1840 and the blizzard was growing worse as two brothers made their way down the long and desolate road. The two young men, aged 14 and 15, were miles from any farm, and they knew they had to find shelter quick, or else they would freeze to death before sunrise. So, it came with great relief when the two brothers spotted McKillop's saloon in the distance, and after making their way through the deep snow, they pushed their way through the heavy door and into the warm, open room. In an instant, it seemed that every eye in the room turned to look upon them. The boys made their way to the roaring fire before hearing the man behind the counter yell that the fire wasn't free and that they must buy something or else they would have to leave. The boys dug deep into their pockets with frozen fingers and searched for whatever money they could find. With only a few cents in hand, the last of their money, the older of the two brothers approached the man and ordered one single coffee for them to share. As the bartender went to retrieve the hot drink, many of those in the bar stopped looking at the young men and returned to their conversations. But one man sitting in the corner continued to stare with angry eyes, a man who had a reputation in the bar for being someone you do not mess with, a man whom all others avoid and give space, a giant butcher with a head of fiery red hair and a long red beard who was known to drink way too much and fight way too often. The butcher watched as the brothers made their way from the bar and took a seat in the chairs set before the roaring fire. He scowled as they removed their wet boots and dripping coats in order to get warmth back into their body. He grumbled as he watched them laugh and joke around as two young men who were happy to be alive would do. The giant man, now extremely bothered by the two young men, rose from his seat and stumbled over to their direction. "Hey, that's my seat," the butcher yelled with a slurred voice. "I'm sorry," said the older boy with a startled tone of confusion. "We didn't know this was your seat. It was empty when we came in and we just sat down to warm ourselves." "Are you calling me a liar? Everyone knows this seat is mine and I want it back now," the butcher shouted. Heads from all around the room turned in the direction of the butcher and the brothers. Some momentarily thought to interject and help quell the situation, but knowing the man they would be stepping in front of, they found it best to stay silent and just let things happen. Others rose to their feet and let a smile overtake their face, for they knew what was about to happen, and they loved watching a good fight. "We would never call you a liar, sir," said the older boy quickly, waving his hands as he spoke. But while doing so, he accidentally struck the butcher on the arm. "We will gladly vacate your seat, and we will move ourselves to another part of the room." But the butcher was no longer listening to the young man speak. The accidental strike on the arm from the boy caused a wave of fury and anger to fill the butcher's large frame. The time for talking was done, and the time for fighting was now. The giant butcher grabbed the scared boy by the collar and pulled the young man towards him. "No one hits me and gets away with it," he roared loudly. The boy struggled to get away, but the grip of the giant man was too tight. "Please don't do this," the boy shouted. "We will leave and never come back. The seat is yours." But no amount of pleading could change the butcher's mind. With one hand still firmly gripping the collar, the butcher grabbed the boy with his other hand and lifted him far above his head. The boy struggled, but there was nothing he could do. The butcher let out a loud, guttural roar and threw the boy headfirst into the fire raging in front of them. There was a moment of stunned silence in the saloon. The only sounds were those of the older brother screaming in agony as the flames engulfed him from head to toe. The younger boy, screaming in terror what he had just witnessed, pleaded for help from anyone in the room. But his request went unanswered as those in the room knew better than to involve themselves with the butcher when he had too much to drink. With tears falling from his bright blue eyes, the boy watched as his older brother crawled out of the fireplace and collapsed under the dirty wooden floor of the saloon. The young man, thinking quickly, tried to beat the flames out with his bare hands, but the damage was already done. His brother was dead on the floor in front of him, burned beyond recognition. The butcher stood above them, grinning sadistically and laughing as the young man cried over the body of his dead brother. "Now," the butcher said to the boy, "it's your turn." The younger boy gasped in fear and jumped to his feet. The butcher reached for him, but the young man proved too quick and avoided the giant hands of the angry man. Angry, the butcher charged towards him, but not wanting to end up suffering the same fate as his brother, took off, out towards the door, and ran out into the raging blizzard. The butcher shouted and roared at the boy fleeing into the darkness. "You best never come back here, boy," the giant man yelled, "for if you do, you will meet the flames." The patrons kept silent as they watched the butcher return to his seat in the corner. They uttered not a sound as they gazed back at the dead boy on the dirty floor near the fireplace. They said not a word as they looked at the coat and shoes left behind by the brother who fled into the snow. They did nothing, and because of this, the frozen body of the younger brother was not found until spring. A few months later, the strong desire for a drink overtook the butcher, and he was compelled to head to McKillop's saloon to feed his demons. While the giant man was unafraid of the dark, and this was the same path he took almost every night to the tavern, there was something eerie about his trip this time. The surrounding area was uncomfortably still, and as he stopped to listen, he became aware of a deathly silence. Thinking it a bit odd and wanting a drink quite badly, the butcher resumed his walk towards the saloon. But as he did, he became aware of what sounded like the large footsteps of a giant animal. With every step the butcher took, the sounds of the footsteps did the same. They walked when he walked, and stopped when he stopped. Shaken and unnerved for the first time in his life, and with heart beating wildly, the butcher turned to see the unknown creature standing behind him. There in the darkness, the butcher laid eyes on a black dog as large as an ox with giant blue eyes and a mouth full of sharp teeth. The butcher froze in terror, as he knew he had seen those blue eyes once before, for those were the same eyes of the boy who had tried desperately to save his burning brother before being driven out into the raging blizzard. The black dog growled softly and stepped forward towards the giant man. The butcher, now terrified, spun around to flee towards the safety of the saloon, but instead of setting eyes on the open, lonely road in front of him, he found himself face to face with a tall figure, fully engulfed from head to toe in flames. The butcher stumbled backwards as the burning figure reached out to grab him with his disfigured hands, blackened by fire. The giant man let out a terrified scream and fell hard to the ground. The figure on fire and the giant black dog crept in close around him, looking down at him as he pleaded for his life. Blood began to bubble from the eyes, and a steady stream poured from his nose. The man tried to scream, but all that came out were gasps for air, as if his lungs were filled with nothing but the smoke of a roaring fire. Reborn by fire and ice, the brothers had returned to Ridgeway, and the butcher was no more. And there you have it. That's the Ridgeway Ghost, Wisconsin's most famous ghost story. Now, while it's fun to tell the story, because it's, you know, it's got the fights, it's got the blood, it's got, you know, murder, it's got vengeance. What makes this story truly interesting is that the Ridgeway ghost itself is actually one of the only ghosts in the entire state of Wisconsin that is thought to be the direct cause of someone's death. The reason for this is because in 1902, December 7th, 1902 to be specific, an article appeared in the New York Times. This article was titled Some Wisconsin Ghosts, and it described two ghosts in particular, one that appeared in a church to a bunch of people, and the other one was on the Ridgeway Ghost. Now, instead of trying to sum this up into just one quick fact, I'm just going to read it so you can see exactly, you know, how they treated these stories back in the day and see what was thought of the Ridgeway Ghost in 1902. And when I say see, I actually mean here. All right, here we go. The other well-authenticated Wisconsin ghost has chosen his haunt in a less urban region and among less cultivated people than the theologians of Nashtoa. Indeed, the scene of his walkings is most artistically chosen in the midst of a wild and savage landscape that would have delighted Dore. Indeed, it is another Brittany both in typography and ethnology for that weird, strange land of Wisconsin's land lead region. With its cairns and pinnacles and citadels of rock, its gloomy, torturous, cavernous vales is inhabited by Celtic folk, Welsh and their kindred of Corn Wales, and a sprinkling of Galwegian Irish, notable ghost seers all. The ghost himself is apparently a remnant of the days when the population of the region was Anglo-Saxon, Virginians, and Kentuckians. The ghost is supposed to be from that of a murder that took place sometime after the Civil War. At any rate, it appears the Ridgeway Township at the spot where the house of this murder took place, which is now a rotting heap of blackened boards. The first person to see the ghost, see it a generation after the murder was committed, was one Dr. Cuttier of Dodgeville, county seat of Iowa County, next town beyond Ridgeway. One night, as the doctor was driving homeward after a visit to a patient in the country, he was suddenly affrighted at seeing a dark figure seated on the pole between the horses. The reins slipped from his nerveless hands, and the horses dashed away at full speed, the specter riding the pole, not being dislodged by the shaking he was getting. Up a hill, down another, and lo, the specter vanished. The doctor's story found little credence, though. He was known to love the flowing bowl, and his friends said he had taken a drop too much. It was a dream, a specter of delirium tremens, of mania. But the doctor declared he was sober. He recalled the fact that a year previous, when he really was a little full, while passing the selfsame haunted spot, he had become aware of a dark and silent stranger sitting beside him in the carriage. For a mile, the stranger rode without saying a word, and all at once he was gone. At the time, the doctor had asked no question of his drunken wits and had considered it a strange experience and nothing more. He was now convinced that the man beside him and the thing on the end of the pole were one and the same, and that a being not of this world. Whereat the people laughed in the daytime. But not long afterwards, the reputation of the doctor received a sudden and terrible vindication, as he was himself afterward to vindicate it almost as terribly. John Lewis, father of Evan Lewis, champion wrestler of the United States, known to sports everywhere, was a prosperous farmer living in the vicinity of Ridgeway. A man of sober life, undaunted courage, and possessed of the tremendous physical strength his son had inherited. He was returning home one fall evening after spending the day assisting a friend in butchering. The night was not dark, and when he drew near the haunted spot, he determined to cut across lots to reach his home. He was approaching the stone wall at the roadside to climb it, when this attention was arrested by the sight of a figure that seemed to have gathered itself together out of the just now tenantless air and stood confronting him in a menacing attitude. He knew of no enemy, and highwaymen were unknown in that retired quarter of the state. He decided that someone must be trying to frighten him, and so he hailed the figure, and no response being given, he advanced upon it. The figure did not budge, but stood a towering shape of blackness, a gigantic and grisly thing. Some unaccountable awe and the uncanny hugeness of the thing made Lewis decide to avoid a conflict, and, drawing his butcher's knife from his pocket, he started to pass by, when the figure, raising its arm with a foreboding gesture, stepped athwart its path. Obeying a hasty impulse that was more a ghastly and soul-chilling fear than it was anger, Lewis let drive his keen knife. Next morning, a neighbor found Lewis lying inside the wall in a semi-conscious condition. Of what happened afterward, he had struck with his knife, he had but vague impressions. He said he had been hurled in the air as if the vortex of a cyclone pounded and crushed into insensibility. He died a few hours after he was carried home, asserting with his dying breath that he had come to his end by a supernatural agency. Thus, did the death of John Lewis make the first vindication of the reputation of Dr. Cutler, and the scoffing ceased. But a second and a third time was the doctor to be vindicated. A dressmaker encountered the ghost, and pursued by it, soon after died of the shock occasioned by the intense fright. At last, Dr. Cutler himself, seeing the ghost for a third time, finally and triumphantly vindicated his word, though at the cost of his own life, for, dying as a result of fright, he became the third of the victims of the impeccable specter of the old military road. Since that time, the ghost has been seen a number of times, seen by the ignorant and the learned, the superstitious and the skeptical. Three agnostics and company averred that they saw it. They offer no attempt at an explanation. They saw it. They believed that some natural causes could explain the apparition, yet so far as their eyes could give them information, they saw a ghost. So what of these ghosts? What explanation can be offered? The writer confesses he is unconvinced, yet he has personal acquaintance with persons who claim to have seen them, with clergymen on the one hand, with university-bred agnostics on the other. The calling of the former ought to prevent them from lying. Even did one believe them predisposed to believe in the reversal of the laws of nature as expounded by the scientific, the latter had no predisposition to affect their judgment. So there you are, and from the evidence presented, can render your own verdict. W. A. Curtis, December 7th, 1902. So yeah, there you have it. There was some short stories about Wisconsin folklore, a ghost story. These are something that I really enjoy. It's always fun searching for these, trying to find new stories, retelling these stories to kind of keep them alive. Yeah, let me know what you think. If you want to hear more, we can definitely look for more. We can do this every few episodes. We can make something fun out of it. If you have any suggestions, let me know. We will continue to talk to more people in the cryptozoology field. And because it always happens, we will also more than likely be talking about more ghosts and supernatural things and pretty much anything else that falls underneath the Fortean umbrella. So, That's where we're going to cut the episode. It's significantly shorter than the last time, the last few, but that's fine. You know, it's a quick little episode, some fun little stories. So, yeah, make sure to check us out on Twitter, at PBI Crypto. We are also on Instagram under Pine Barrens Institute. Make sure to head over to the website, pinebarrensinstitute.com. We have a bunch of articles on various cryptids, old newspaper articles about cryptids found or reported on in Wisconsin. We have lumberjack folktales. We have a lot of things going on over there. We also have links if you are so inclined to buy shirts. We also have a donate button. We have all that fun stuff. You can also follow some links over there, and you can go to some of our friends, their websites, their podcasts. So yeah, definitely make sure to check it out. Subscribe if you haven't already. Rate and review. Do all the normal podcast stuff. Or don't. It's up to you. You know, I just put it out there. You can do with it what you will. So with that said, this is Adam from the Pine Barrens Institute, and bye.